Reading from The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the 15th. The worthy and popular Lord Rook came thundering ashore at Libertatia in a towering rage, and quite right, too, since the pirate villains had set him cruelly adrift. He had been sailing in circles, not his fault, mind, but that lubber Yardley's, and met with misadventures fit to curl his grizzled hair, for a full and luxuriant growth had his lordship, and those tales about his being bald beneath his wig were malicious forecastle gossip. Aye, thanks to Yardley's bungling, the longboat with its loyal castaways had blundered around the Indian Ocean, hitting reefs, splitting strakes, fouling oil platforms, and finally getting pinched by a Burmese coast guard for illegal fishing. His subsequent appearance in police court, confiscation of tackle, scathing remarks from the bench, sentenced to death by the thousand cuts, and unfavorable press publicity had worn the admiral's patience thin by the time he and his crew had filed through their shackles with the bosun's manicure set, tunneled out of the condemned hold, overpowered the crew of a dilapidated junk, set fire to Rangoon, had a vitriolic argument with the harbor master, and finally put to sea, his lordship's temper was beginning to boil. Capture by Borneo pirates, slavery at the oar of a galley, escape by swimming down the crocodile-infested Papar River, and having to pay over the odds for passage west on a coal boat, did nothing to restore his good humor, and by the time he and his whining followers had landed at Libertatia, where the coal boat accidentally ran aground, the admiral was fit to bite lumps out of the pier, nor was his temper improved by the discovery that all the pirates had slipped off to the Caribbean. Like all other visitors to that port or missing men, Rook wound up in the establishment of Vladimir Mackintosh Grunbaum, demanding transport at the top of his voice. Vladimir, who was busy calculating what Avery's annual income would be, with bonuses and graduated cost of living by the time he was 40, surveyed the ragged but imposing admiral calmly and asked, "Business or pleasure?"
"Both, damn your eyes!" bellowed Rook. "No, little shyster, that I command His Majesty's East Indies squadron, wherever the hell it is, and my urgent need is a sloop to the Cape, there to raise my powers and smite the brethren of the coast. Business, aye, and rare pleasure, spit me, to hail those bloody rascals to execution dock."
Vladimir shook his head sympathetically.
"Sorry, mate, you're too late. My boy's taking care of 'em."
"Your what?"
blared Rook, bewildered.
"My boy, Cap'n Ben Avery," explained Vladimir complacently. "He's probably got most of 'em under wraps by now. Well, he's been gone 3 weeks, hasn't he? Bags of time for a fit young chap like him to pull the rug out from—"
"Avery!"
bawled Rook apoplectically, and shattered Vladimir's desk with a blow of his horny fist. Timber and split tea flew amain.
"That forsworn weasel, that renegade yard of Brill Cream, he that betrayed us, the cowardly napkin-carrier, the smooth-soul, purse-snapping pimp, with his Oxenford airs and his safety-razor. Damn him to hell! He'll be the first to go up in the air by this hand, aye, tarred and filleted, and a clank and chains neath high water-mark. Rot his patent leather pointy-toed boots!"
"Begin your lordship's parding, but if I was you," interposed Vladimir frostily, "I'd watch me lip. That slander, that is, afore witnesses. God, I'll bet they can hear you're in Bombay. Nah, take it easy, stop turning purple, and perpend."
He raised an admonitory, unwashed hand before the goggling admiral.
"One thing at a time, or rather, three things.
And so saying, he rummaged in the splintered remains of his top drawer, and displayed before the other's stupefied gaze three dull crosses of undoubted gold, crusted with gems. In one shone the blue radiance of an enormous sapphire, the second was alight with the shimmering white of a splendid opal, and the emerald in the third rivaled a golite for size and brilliance.
"Why don't you sit down, your lordship?" suggested Vladimir considerately, "and I'll get the boy to fetch you a cup of cocoa with something in it."
Rook subsided, giving a creditable imitation of a turkey in labor, and Vladimir continued,
"Where'd I get 'em, you may be asking? Well, I'll tell you. Where but from my client, Captain Avery, what you been miscalling so reckless?"
His gesture stilled Rook's explosion of amaze and protest.
"I dunno what rags of the gutter press you've been reading, my lord," he added severely, "or what malicious scuttlebutt has been dropped in your dainty shell-likes. But I'm here to testify that Captain Avery, far from betraying anythink, has been flying round the seven seas like an hawk with a wasp up its frock, recovering bits of Madagascar crown faster than I can enter 'em in me book. Oh, and he's signed off Akbar the Damned permanent, just by the way."
Rook couldn't believe it, of course, but there were the three crosses, and when it finally sank in, the Admiral's bellowings of disbelief turned to eruptions of delight. He punched the air, threw up the remnants of his hat, stamped around the room, and reduced a chest of drawers to matchwood in his glee. It was, rather, reflected Vladimir gloomily, like having a disgruntled firebeard loose on the premises. At last the Admiral sank back, fanning his beaming brow.
"I'm all took aback," he roared. "Sink me, that's a noble lad, and I misjudged him. Nay, but I'll hear no evil of him after this. Why, that lying hell-spite Sheba! She misled me a' purpose. Damn me what she did! Brazen as monkeys, butter wouldn't melt. Told me young Ben had ratted. Never batted an eyelid. Women, by cock!" he rumbled. "It makes you wonder. And that sterling young fella has copped back three of the crosses already.
Well, just like that. Probably got t'other three by now and all."
"And sent bloody Akbar post-haste to hell!"
Rook shook his massive head in admiration, then grew more sober.
"Mind you, he could do no less. After all, 'tis no more than making amends for losing the crown in the first place. Deuced careless, that!"
"Off a mo!" cried Vladimir indignantly. "You ain't heard nothing yet, my lord. He also rescued your lordship's daughter from hell of shame and slavery."
"Me daughter?"
Rook gaped in sudden recollection.
"Little vanity! Slife, I knew there was another score against those pirate villains. But rescued? Nay, where, sirrah? How? My darling child, where is she?"
"Well, now," said Vladimir primly, "I look arter Captain Avery's business affairs, but 'tain't for me to pry into his private life, is it? Mind you, I did hear talk of a desert island-like," he added, reflecting guiltily that he hadn't bothered to have vanity collected from Abe's.
Rook started violently.
"An island? Do you mean she and Avery have been on Tropic Isle together? Alone? Huh?"
His brow darkened ominously, and he took grizzled chin in mighty paw.
"Gad's death! My little innocent, solitary man, and she a tender virgin maid! Nay, there's food for thought, rabbit me!"
"Blimey, you're hard to please," snapped Vladimir. "I wish it had been one of my bleeding daughters, but they're all orphans, begging and thieving and working the kitchen lay round Aldgate Pump. We've never a thought for their poor old dad, what brought 'em up to the age of 3 and 4 in Galeen's case."
He sniffed and wiped away an oily tear.
"Ungrateful little bastards. You're bleeding lucky," he added resentfully. "I mean, I'm glad to be Captain Avery's agent, but I'd a sight sooner be his flaming father-in-law, wouldn't I?"
"Father-in-law?"
Rook went purple. "You tell me the dog aspires to my daughter's hand? He, a penniless captain, a landless nobody, and she the daughter of a peer and admiral and tennis captain of Cheltenham ladies?"
"You weren't," exclaimed Vladimir incredulously.
"Not me, you fool, her," roared Rook. "Why, here's insolence. Why, the upstart rascal. Not," he admitted reasonably, "that he isn't a dab hand at recovering stolen goods and slaughtering corsairs, but damn it, I design her for a certain duke's son."
"Cafe, society, riffraff," scoffed Vladimir. "Not in the same class as my boy Ben. Look, Gov, get realistic. It's an investment, see? I mean, you're not going to be short of a bob in your old age if your daughter was married to that ball of fire, are you? He's going places, is that boy, and by the time he's finished toughing up the Coast Brotherhood, he'll be laughing all the way to the bank."
Rook's complexion faded to beetroot, and he plucked thoughtfully at a lip like a life belt.
"You tell me," he said at last, and shook perplexed head. "I knew not what to say."
"Bless you, my children should cover it," said Vladimir. "You want to push this thing along, my lord."
"You think so?" wondered Rook, and frowned. "What the hell am I discussing my intimate family affairs with you for, anyway? What's my daughter's future to thee, shyster?"
"She's going to be my client-in-law, so to speak," said Vladimir. "I got a sort of avuncular interest, and I reckon these two young lovebirds need all the help they can get from us older and wiser heads. So while I continue to manage the business side, why don't your lordship get your fleet together? Our boy's raging round the Caribbean at the moment, beating the bejesus out of every pirate in sight, but I'm sure he'd be grateful for any assistance from his loving father-in-law-to-be."
Vladimir stroked his nose conspiratorially. "And afterwards, if you was to report favourably on his conduct to the King and Admiralty, well, it wouldn't hurt his prospects, would it?"
"I suppose not," rumbled the Admiral pensively.
He eyed Vladimir shrewdly.
"You see a bright future for the lad, huh? A rich future?"
"Stinkin'," replied Vladimir. "The prize money from this lot, he'll be able to buy half of Yorkshire."
"There's the mortgage on Torpedo Towers," mused Rook. "And between ourselves, vanity costs a packet."
"Not any more, she wouldn't," chuckled Vladimir.
"Begod, no! He'd have to support her. Well, the young must face their responsibilities sooner or later."
"And repay the love and care of elders, what guided their youthful footsteps."
"Thou sayest true, Master Pawnbroker. Why, have we not earned our repose?"
"You better believe it, squire. Slaving over accounts."
"Assembling fleets."
"Sacrificing our today for their tomorrow."
"Mind you, that's what life's all about, I suppose, and they're worth it, bless 'em."
"Oh, yes, a lovely couple."
The upshot was that Lord Rook sailed for the Cape on the next tide, there to summon his fleet, and Vladimir, pondering their conversation, wondered if it was not time that he too shifted operations to his Caribbean branch office, there to keep a closer eye on his protégé. After all, hero though he might be, Captain Avery was a right mug in worldly matters, and would be none the worse of his agent's guiding presence, if only to count the prize money and outstanding Madagascar crosses which ought to be rolling in by now. So where a lesser man, and they didn't come much lesser than Vladimir normally, would have kept a safe distance from the action, Master Mackintosh Groombaum put up his shutters, packed his bags, and took a through ticket to Port Royal, change for Nassau, Roatan, and the Mosquito Coast. He travelled first, since he was on his client's business, and consoled himself that it was all deductible anyway. Now, this happened on the very day that Avery and Sheba were escaping from Cartagena into Injun country, and vanity and blood were falling into the hands of the Cohocco Guzlans. What has since happened to them, we know,
but it may be as well to pause for station identification on some of our other characters who haven't been heard from for a while. Happy Dan Pugh, for example, we left nursing his fractured heart and leafing moodily through Lesson 1, Je suis, tu es, il est, etc. Oh, poor devil. While he cruised dazedly towards Tortuga, thanks to his vanity trauma, he had forgotten all about joining Bilbo at Cartagena. Which was just as well, since when last seen, Bilbo, Firebeard, and Goliath were leaving the city at high speed, with Lardo's soldiers taking futile potshots after their canoe. Let's see where they went. If you and I had been in their shoes, a horrid thought when you consider that odor-eaters had still to be invented, we would have continued downstream in top gear. But Bilbo reasoned coolly that his ship, the Laughing Sandbag, must still be lurking secure off the coast, since the Spaniards couldn't conceivably have found her yet. Accordingly, he and his companions quickly beached their canoe and took to the woods, Firebeard carrying the wooden legless Goliath as they struck out for the coast. A grueling march it was, of a kind that nowadays would be attempted only with two-way radios, survival gear, nylon anoraks, and sponsorship by several sporting goods firms, and even so would probably end in disaster and air-sea rescue. But those were the days when Morgan and Dampier and their crews were wont to plunge into trackless, fever-ridden jungle with a handful of salt and a cutlass, hack their unerring way to where the loot was, fight their half-starved battles against impossible odds, hack their way back again, and so home, thinking nothing of it. To Bilbo, who could read the stars as easily as a book, and carried his own radar in his head, the 20 miles to the sea were a mere irritating formality. 12 hours solid jungle bashing, and Firebeard acting as a foliage plough, and Goliath singing, "Climb every mountain," brought them within sight of the sea. They were ripped and bitten and bloody from their ordeal, and virtually out on their feet. Foot, in Goliath's case, with hunger, thirst, and exhaustion. But Bilbo had hit the coast within half a mile of their ship, and long before the guardacostas had peeped warily beyond Isla Baru, the Laughing Sandbag had slipped like a black phantom out to sea. She prowled the shore for a few days, on the chance that Sheba might appear, and then sheered off to a convenient desert isle to careen, lay in wood and water, and have Goliath fitted with a new wooden leg from the local tree surgeon. Bilbo had lost his toupee in the woods and got the sailmaker to knit him a new one in secret, but it looked awful, and he had no choice but to wear his plumed hat permanently, which was a fearful nuisance in the tropic heat, particularly during the games of rounders and head tennis with which the pirates beguiled their leisure. So now we know what Bilbo and Firebeard are doing. Loafing, let's face it. And it is time to turn to sterner matters, for while we have been gathering in these lesser strands of our tale, Spanish devilment has broken loose, all unsuspected, behind our backs, and in the sneakiest possible way. 'Twas thus, you mind how Don Lardo, out upon him, vowed to launch a great campaign to sweep all right-thinking opposition from the Caribbean? Aye, says you, we mind. But would you believe that he's actually got it under way already, and us none the wiser? Never, says you, 'tis thing impossible. Why, he's been fully occupied massacring Cahuacho Guzlans, and being beastly to vanity, and offering to pull blood asunder, and the like of that. Aye, to be sure, he has, but elsewhere, his minions have been at their evil employs. Listen to this, and tremble. Before sallying forth from Cartagena to hunt down our fleeing principals, the crafty viceroy had sent a fast sloop scudding north to Santo Domingo of Hispaniola with urgent commands to his governor there, Don Toro Molinos, to open the campaign with a sudden assault on the great buccaneer stronghold of Tortuga. Aye!
So now, on the very morn when Lardo himself was digging up the treasure which Blood had betrayed, and gnashing his dentures exultantly, while Bilbo and Firebeard were lapping up the bread of idleness and piña colada on their careening island, while Happy Dan Pugh was sailing along revising Une Promenade aux Bicyclettes, and not making much of it, while Avery was being carried off ever farther by the slave traders, while Vladimir was joining in the keep fit class on the games deck of his westering packet, and Admiral Rook was trying to get his show on the road at the Cape on that selfsame morn, a great red and gold fleet descended on Tortuga like a garlic thunderbolt, forced the rocky harbor of Kiona before anyone was out of bed, shattered its forts with broadsides, and stormed the buccaneer ships drowsing at anchor. Pacing the gilded quarterdeck of his great galleon, the Misconception, Don Toro Molinos twirled haughty mustache with lean, swarthy hand emerging from a cruel froth of priceless Mechlin lace as he watched his guns pounding the hapless pirate ships, smashing buckets, severing washing lines, damaging machines on the promenade, and generally creating havoc. Pirates were falling overboard, some only half-dressed, and with their breakfasts untasted. Piles of plunder awaiting inventory on the dockside were scattered by cannon shots. Floods of rum cascaded through the alleyways, and as he bounded from his office at the Filibusters Cooperative and raced for the harbor, Calico Jack Rackham could see that much more of this, and Tortuga would be closed for the season. In a trice, he had buttoned his pristine shirt, adjusted his headscarf, dragged his sozzled crew from the haunts and hells, sent for the fire brigade, posted his will, and got sail on the Plymouth Corporation's Revenge. Plainly, all was lost. Tortuga was aflame. Spaniards were pouring ashore in curled wigs with primed arquebuses. The harbor was a hell of burning hulls and wet buccaneers. Don Toro was quaffing a celebratory cup of rich Malaga on his poop before landing in person, and Rackham saw little point in hanging about. With sailorly skill he warped his great ship through the inferno, its crew bravely manning the yards, sheets, topsails, and ship's laundry, wholly stoning the scuppers, opening the bar, and even throwing things at their attackers. Somehow she fought her way clear. With the loss of only her three masts and the bosun's Wellingtons carelessly left on the after rail, the crew hauled feverishly on the sweeps, and the sole survivor of the once mighty pirate fleet escaped to sea, followed by a storm of chain shot and canister and taunts of "Windy!" in Spanish. The overthrow of the Coast Brotherhood's great haven was complete, and Calico Jack, tight-lipped and with the daddy of all migraines coming on, could only flee to the safety of the Windward Passage. He was not greatly cheered up when, 2 days later, he ran into the Tortuga-bound Frantic Frog, for Happy Dan was having one of his turns again, and lay on the hammock in the psychiatrist's berth, whimpering about "ooh" endings. Taking overall command, Rackham put his crippled vessel in tow to the Frenchman, and ordered a course for his own private lair on the far side of the Caribbean, at the strange settlement of Roatan, of which more anon. There he would refit and retrench, pick up the latest news and some clean white shirts, send scouts to find how Bilbo and Sheba were doing at Cartagena. He's in for a nasty start, by the powers! And try to discover why the Dons were getting energetic all of a sudden. Dark care sat heavily on the broad shoulders of the buccaneer chief as he brooded his way slowly southwards. He was used, was Calico Jack, to being the sheet-anchor of that wild fraternity, and never had he felt such a burden of responsibility as now, when catastrophe had overtaken the Brotherhood. Square chin in strong hand, he stood on his battered quarter-deck, listening to the rats playing in the bilges and the crew moaning through the rigging, and ever the same fateful question came to trouble his mind and make him grit his mighty teeth in near despair. Why, oh, why the hell, he kept asking himself, hadn't he listened to his parents' advice and taken that office job with Somerset County Council? Look, if Rackham thinks he's got trouble, he's not the only one. Things are in desperate shape all round. Why, at this rate, it'll be Dunlardo who scoops the pool and goes sailing off triumphantly into the sunset on the last page, and God help the history of Western civilization then. All right, you may say it all comes of leaving Avery in the hands of slave traders through the whole of the last chapter. Good point, and we agree it's time he started earning his corn again, but he's going to need a little help from his friends, and in especial one, a rotund, ill-shaven, fatly furtive figure lately come ashore at that weird cesspool of the western seas known as Roatan, where anything can happen, and is just about to.